Small Business and Startup Stories DSM features conversations with small business owners who share both their victories and failures on their path to success. Small Business and Startup Stories DSM is produced by the Greater Des Moines Partnership. More tips and resources are available at dsmpartnership.com/small business. I'm your host, Mike Caldwell.
Nadelia Gomez, welcome to Startup Stories. You have a PhD in applied plant sciences, plant breeding, and genetics. When did you first discover your interest in plants?
I was probably an eighth grader when I started to be concerned about what I would do when I grow up. And at that time, I asked my dad how he figured out what he was going to do. Mm-hmm. And he says, combine something that you really love with something that has a big impact in humanity. And at that time, my thought was, there's no bigger impact than solving world hunger. Mm-hmm. And I really loved science, so it made sense.
That simple, really?
Yep.
Wow. Did you stay that way from eighth grade on? Did you ever waver, go, now I'm interested in this, and come back? Or did you pretty much stay focused on it?
I stayed pretty much focused and determined on that path. At some point, maybe I considered animal science, but they're really hard to track and they move and bite.
They do, yes, among other things.
So I decided plants would be okay.
They do a lot of other things. I grew up around a farm. I can tell you they cause all kinds of side effects. So you started your life in the country of Panama. What brought you to the U.S.?
One of the interesting things that really appealed to me about the University of Minnesota was that they had a multidisciplinary program. And so when I was finished with my degree at the University of Panama, the opportunity to combine ecology, conservation science with plant breeding and genetics and agronomy, it made sense to me. So that connection between the concepts and the practices is really what brought me to the U.S.
Okay. And you moved from a equatorial climate straight into cold winter.
That's right.
How'd that go? I'm curious what that was like for you.
Well, so Panama is 7 degrees above north of the equator.
Right.
And that means that the sun rises at 6 and it sets at 6. And
all year round.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's a dry and a rainy season. And during the rainy season, sometimes it doesn't rain. And during the dry season, sometimes it's rain. So it's pretty much the same thing throughout. Minnesota was a big, big change.
Yeah.
And probably the most important change was just the daylight. I would go in to study when it was dark. And I would come out from a very closed-in lab when it was dark.
Oh,
and that was
yeah.
very, very strange.
It was like that for me in Seattle in the wintertime.
Yep.
But then the summer came.
That's right. And the seasonality is phenomenal.
Yes.
I mean, just seeing that change from one season to the next, you don't get that in Panama.
No, you don't get four seasons
like
we get it in the upper Midwest. So you went through your PhD program to a role at DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
I found it interesting you were developing information management tools. Why not straight into plant breeding?
Well, plant breeding had changed dramatically in the time period since I was an eighth grader to the time period that I was ready to jump into the job.
Okay. How did it change?
Well, if you think about how plant breeding was done back in the time with Norman Borlaug, who was one of my heroes when I was a kid, the process involved growing a lot of plants, measuring them, selecting the best ones, crossing those, and repeating that over and over and over again.
Hybridization.
That's right. And the challenge of doing so is that you are constrained by the number of plants that you can grow and measure and the space that you need to be able to grow them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
By the time computer science had made such progress that it could be easy to simulate these scenarios, the impact of utilizing that data-driven approach in breeding created tons of new opportunities for research information management type jobs associated
sense.
With plant breeding.
So not only all the different skill sets you learn from a plant and biology standpoint, but then throw IT into the mix.
That's exactly right.
So did you get a comp sci degree or a database degree? Just learned it on the way.
No. In fact, the story of how I got the job is really interesting. My friend called me. He had been in the plant breeding program with me. Mm-hmm. And he says, we have this job. And I read the job description and it was in IT.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, he must have
sent
this wrong.
You sent the wrong one.
And it turns out that they needed someone with that background in plant breeding to help connect the software developers with the scientists and be able to bridge the gap.
That makes sense. Because it's all terminology and process and understanding. And
that's right. And so that was really what happened. I jumped into this role utilizing that subject matter expert space and help the software developers connect more closely with their new customers, the breeders.
Interesting. Precision agriculture is a term that is thrown around in the ag tech space frequently. What is precision ag?
Precision ag is the collection of concepts and practices that allow a farming operation to apply just what is needed, when is needed, in the amount that is necessary for the plant or a livestock to grow.
That's about the most clear explanation I've ever heard. Thank you, because I got to be honest with you. I've heard so many different things ascribed to precision ag. We do precision ag, and you dig in deep. I'm an investor, and as an investor, I'm always saying, well, tell me more. Explain that to me. I don't understand. And there were people who were telling me they did precision ag, but they couldn't tell me what precision ag was.
So I'll give you a good example of what I used to teach my students when I was teaching what precision ag was about. In Orange County, there were orchards back in 1970s, and there are historical photos of a truck carrying a big container of water.
Okay.
And the truck would drive very closely next to the plants, and somebody would be scooping out water and applying it just at the base of that plant. In a way, that was the earliest concept, right? A one way to think about precision agriculture. You're precisely adding the amount of water in that place, not throwing it everywhere in the field, right?
Right.
But it is not the precision agriculture that emerged in 1990s, where geographic positioning systems that you could apply to tractors could tell you not only where you were located on the surface of the earth, but how much moisture there is in the ground and how what stage of the plant the plant is at, how much water it's consuming. So it's the ability really of being able to measure that and then apply the amount necessary at the time that it's needed that really transformed our thinking and technology around precision agriculture. So we were practicing it to some extent. It just had not been able to be used as well as we use it now.
In other words, we became more precise.
There you go.
So you led a team of people with diverse backgrounds in building these data-driven support tools. Was that your first experience in leading a team?
I would say no.
Okay.
I think that in order to get that role, I had to practice leading smaller teams in less ambiguous scenarios or lower risk scenarios. So even the roles that I had before that, I had to have some level of evolution between I'm an individual contributor just doing my work and, you know, putting in the hours to saying now I'm leading a team. And that team at that beginning stage could be very small. And the project that I was leading was very small. So by the time I actually led my own team in decision support systems for breeders and agronomists, and that was more advanced.
It wasn't step one.
Well,
that's good, because having been through a similar process of leading a few people and then to a ton, a lot, you don't want to jump into a lot early on. So you ended your career at DuPont as a research scientist. And looking back now, I'm curious, how well did your work at DuPont, which is far from a startup company, about as far as you can get, help you prepare to lead an ag tech accelerator?
The last 18 months that I was in that role, I truly had a sense of building these small intrapreneurial teams within the large company. It is a really rewarding experience to have a research scientist title, but also be enabled to explore many different aspects of that research pipeline. And so the experience in that role was quite transferable. You wanted to be able to build these teams, support and enable them, mm-hmm. make sure that they have clarity and focus on what they were working, and also and allow them to pivot as needed. Yeah. All of these elements are transferable.
And pivoting is not a common concept in large corp.
Correct. And so that evolution from saying, yes, it is a large company, mm-hmm. but within it, there are these small teams that are trying to move in an very iterative, dynamic way.
Yeah.
That is the stepping...
That's startup.
That's right.
That's startup. Can you give us an example maybe of one of the things that was worked on that worked out well without breaking any confidences of DuPont or anything? But
sure. Many of them are in this space of precision agriculture and predictive agriculture. The ability not only to measure what is there and add what is needed in terms mm-hmm. of inputs in the farming operation, but also being able to predict when something is going to be in short supply. And so
Well in advance,
where you can actually take action on it.
Sure.
So many of the projects that we had were things that transferred from understanding what are the decisions that the farmers need to make. Is it irrigating? Is it applying pesticides? When should they be applied? How mm-hmm. much? Mm-hmm. And being able to predict the right timing of those applications.
That makes perfect sense. So what made you interested in taking the role of executive director of the Iowa AgriTech Accelerator?
I think it was one of those opportunities that I would regret passing up if I didn't jump into it.
Yeah.
I had been a mentor with the accelerator, and I had experienced that enthusiasm and energy that the entrepreneurs bring. I also was very well aware that the ag industry at large was changing and that the opportunities that were brought about by consumer preferences and other problems like how to respond to the need for clean water and soil quality and health. And it just seemed like there was a lot more opportunity that was occurring outside of the large companies alone, and that this ecosystem required farmers, small businesses, large ag incumbents, even tech giants to jump in together and try to solve those big problems.
Yeah, because they were problems that nobody talked about 25
That's
years
right.
ago.
And so maybe in a way, Mike, it goes back to that eighth grader thinking about, you know, what are you passionate about? Yeah. What really motivates you?
Yeah.
And what is the biggest problem that you can solve? And this was an opportunity to stretch my wings outside of one single company and understand the ecosystem as a whole and identify those opportunities that could position Iowa as the premier place to come and investigate these questions.
Yeah, so, and it's well positioned because Iowa's already known well. It's interesting. You know, it's when we started the Insurance Accelerator, people in Des Moines, most of them knew we had insurance here, but very few people had any clue that Des Moines, Iowa was one of the top, like, three or four global insurance cities. Global.
Yeah.
And it's just not what people think of. But when you come to ag, I mean, to this day, I'll meet somebody from somewhere else and they'll ask me if I live on a farm. And it's like, no, I don't live on a farm. The vast majority of Iowans do not live on a farm. We love our farmers, but they're like 4% of our population. So,
well, remember, one of my big heroes was Norman Borlaug.
Yeah, right.
And so growing up, I knew that Iowa was connected with a very long history of generating innovations in agriculture.
Yeah.
And so I actually have come to realize that we are well known worldwide for this. And we just are so fortunate to have it right here in our backyards.
Yeah, we really are. So you've been leading the accelerator for less than a year, but you've already accomplished a significant amount. Can you tell me about our newest investor?
Yes, I am super excited. We have a new investor joining our accelerator. Onset has been a leading manufacturer and supplier of data loggers, and their systems have been utilized indoors, outdoors, underwater to measure agricultural inputs to measure the quality of environmental characteristics. This is an area that would really enhance a lot of the startups that are coming in.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Because it brings the technology and connects it with the agricultural.
So they're putting devices right on the edge.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, interesting. So you have a role in the Cultivation Corridor Cultivo program. What is Cultivo and how are you and the accelerator involved?
Cultivo is a program led by the Cultivation Corridor to bring startups from all over the world. And these startups will come in small groups, one country at a time. And they will have an opportunity to connect with ag industry leaders here, recognize the resources that are available for them to consider entering this market, and incentivizing them to expand their opportunities, including bringing in some of those ideas to Iowa. Our involvement will be through the expertise that we've already attained by leading the accelerator. We will be bringing in some program content. We will be bringing in some mentorship connections. And we will be helping with the logistic on this inaugural Cultivo program that's going to happen in May.
So you're in the process of selecting the fourth class for the accelerator. Can you tell us how things are going?
It's going really well. I have received so many emails, phone calls, invitations to meet with entrepreneurs from all over the world. We have folks from Spain and Nigeria and Zimbabwe, as well as people here in the Midwest that are reaching out asking, what are the resources that are available for me if I were to apply to your program? And I think the exciting thing about all this, too, is that there's a very broad range of diverse types of ag tech startups that are coming in, and the opportunity for us to bring really quality startups to this cohort in 2020 is promising.
So you anticipate having a lot to choose from?
I hope so.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So tell me more about how you select the participants. I mean, what filters do you use or what questions do you ask?
There's a little bit of an art and science here for sure, and they are very early stage, so making a 100% guarantee that it's going to be exactly what it is
highly unlikely.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So what we're focusing on is basically four different elements that we believe are important ingredients to the recipe of a successful startup. First, how well do you know your customer, your target audience? The people that you're going to help, and how well do you understand the pain points and problems that they have?
My smile doesn't show through on a podcast, but this is one of my, I think it's now the number one reason product or companies fail, startup companies fails. It used to be cash flow. Now it's product market fit, knowing what the customer actually wants to pay for.
That's right.
Not what they say they'd like to have.
That's right.
So what's the next one?
The next one is understanding the product or the service. Is it viable? Does it actually work? Is this a technology that can really be robust?
Yeah.
The third one is a business model that can be examined, interrogated, that you can change and modify and improve over time. But you've got to have that in order to be able to say, yes, this is a viable.
And you know, it's funny because most people really don't understand what a business model is. And it sounds terribly complex, and it's not really terribly complex, but there are so many ways that people buy or acquire the things they need. And sometimes you're acquiring it by renting, by leasing, by buying something else that this is included in. And for a lot of the people that do startups, they don't know.
That's exactly right, Mike.
Is that an area that you see the mentors helping out with?
Absolutely. All of these areas that I'm mentioning are areas where we know that we can provide some type of assistance, expertise, professional guidance. And it doesn't mean that the thing that they come into has to be set in stone. What we're looking for is that ability to take that feedback and rapidly iterate through the process of figuring out, is this a better business model than what I started with?
And I think most people don't realize that that is exactly what happens to almost every startup that goes one of these accelerator programs, whether it's the ones here in Iowa or anywhere else in the world, is that the idea is to go through your learning process faster.
That's exactly
right. That's the word accelerate. And to me, I've seen companies do what if they were on their own, probably 2 years of learning and do it in 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing to watch.
And that leads us then to the last criteria. That team of founders needs to be able to take on that feedback and translate it very quickly into those measurable outcomes that can help you know, are we on the right track?
Right.
And so the fourth element is just that team characteristic. Do we have that strong, resilient team that will find those challenges, but will hear that advice and try to iterate really quickly?
Yeah, and that's a challenge. I mean, I've done some mentoring for many years I've been mentoring, but you have people that don't want to listen to feedback.
Yeah, it's hard. It's very hard.
There's no reason for them to come to the accelerator if they don't want to listen to feedback.
That's right.
We're not here for really any other reason than getting them great feedback.
Yes.
So it's interesting when I would imagine you've interviewed a few people that it's pretty obvious pretty quickly they really don't want to listen.
Yeah, we are really evaluating them on that potential, but we have to have some cases, some examples where that potential demonstrates its the possibility of it to become realized.
Mm-hmm.
We find ourselves sometimes interviewing startups that are farther along in certain aspects of these four criteria.
Right.
If they're too far along, there might be very little that they can do in 100 days to really accelerate.
Right.
So we're not trying to look for startups that are perfect in all of these four aspects.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for startups that can utilize those mentors, that advice, that feedback, and accelerate during those 100 days to be in a better position at the end than when they started.
Yeah, people can take advantage of what's offered by the accelerator.
That's right.
So what does the 100-day program look like for the companies coming in June 1? Can you kind of overview the schedule not the specific dates, but in general, what happens?
It's a very exciting 100 days, I would say. And I say that having been a mentor myself, but also as I prepare to enter into this 2020 session.
Mm-hmm.
It starts off with the opportunity for each startup to recognize what are the areas that they want to improve upon. We provide three types of scenarios. Some program content is defined. They will be required to learn about business models and fundraising and the expectation that investors have. So those are things that are part of our standard program. There's also the opportunity for weekly meetings with an entrepreneur in residence.
Mm-hmm.
This allows the startup founder to have accountability for those things that they will be doing on a weekly basis and to iterate them in a much more customizable way so that it is relevant to them as they progress and focus on the areas that they need to improve.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last part is a much more fluid set of opportunities. These are panel discussions or these are groups of startups that we might bring in together from alumni groups or from various parts of the startup community here so that they can really explore as a group what it takes to become a startup. And all of this is in the context of ag industry leaders, people with experience in agriculture, people with experience building businesses. So I think the mentor connections that we enable during that period of time should become strategic partnerships in the future for these startups.
Yeah, and I think it's something most people don't realize is that a lot of these relationships that build don't end.
Nope, they do not.
When the 100-day program ends, we've got people that went through the very first year's programs that are still very tightly connected to certain mentors and other people they've met along the way. And that's, if you think about what great businesses have, they have networks. Great networks of all types of people and companies. And it's another thing that we basically are accelerating with what you do. Speaking of mentors, talk more about mentor speed meetings. What is that like?
It's extremely fun. This is the time where you connect the startups with as many possible mentors in our program so that they get to mutually know what benefits could come out of that partnership.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of logistical components to it, making sure that we have the right environment to facilitate these interactions. We provide guidance and coaching to the startups regarding the mentor's background, and we provide also some information to the mentors about the startups and their profile. Mm-hmm. And when they come together for those 20, 30 minutes, they're really in this sort of speed dating mode. They're trying to get to know each other. Right. And they're also trying to say, what is in this relationship that can benefit us both?
Right.
And that's really important. That you talked about how these mentorship relationships sometimes extend beyond the 100 days. These connections are meaningful at many levels. You may be an expert in the seed business. Mm-hmm. And your knowledge might actually also be transferable to somebody exploring marketing challenges for a different type of business.
Right.
So during those 30 minutes that they're interacting, they're getting to know each other. And at the end, they come up with a list of, here are the areas that I really would like to improve. Here are the mentors that I met that could really be a match. The mentors also say, I'm really interested in helping these startups. I know that I can provide value to them. And we go through a process of matching them up.
Sure. And having been through this, I think it's important to understand that they may have 10 or 12 meetings a day.
Absolutely.
30 minutes at a time over. And they do this for a couple of weeks.
Yes.
So it goes on. It's very intense. It's interesting to see, though, that even over those 10 or 12 days or whatever it is, their ability to present just keeps getting better and better and better.
Absolutely.
Because along with all the mentor interaction, you're doing your presentation of 50, 75, 100 times. And so you've got to get a little better at it.
Yes. And that iterative process of practicing is super critical, because we are trying to get them so comfortable with all of the elements of their business, but they very often just have 5, 10, 15 minutes to condense everything.
Right.
So it's the tip of the iceberg that has to really showcase what is below all of this that they have worked so hard to build.
Oh, yeah. And it's much, much harder to say something in a few minutes than it is a couple hours.
Very difficult.
Very difficult. And I've always found that some of the people are just so excited, they want to tell you everything.
That's right.
Their origin story and the product origin story and the first customer they ever talked to. And it's like, oh my gosh, we don't have all day. So
it takes practice, and it takes a willing group of mentors that are interested in helping these startups grow so that they have the safe environment to do that.
So where do you see the Iowa AgriTech Accelerator going in the next 5 years?
Oh, I dream big. I want to imagine the accelerator being the preferred spot for startups in ag tech. I'd like to see a vibrant community of mentors, ag incumbents, tech giants, small and large companies directly connected to farmers that can start to test and evaluate the value of these products and services. And I would love to see many different outcomes from this. Not all startups will end up being the next big ag company.
Absolutely not. The majority won't.
And many entrepreneurs may find themselves having to take the very difficult, bold choice of saying, I'm stepping out of this.
Yeah.
However, the impact that we will have at the level of the state, in the Midwest, and globally should elevate the awareness of the very important problems that there are to solve in agriculture.
Yeah.
The big opportunities that we have, we all are consumers of the agricultural system.
Right.
And so being able to be engaged at that level, I think, will transform not only the future startups, but our entire agricultural production process.
Well, I agree with you completely. And I want to thank you, Nadilia Gomez, for being on Startup Stories.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening to the Small Business and Startup Stories DSM podcast. Inspired by these stories, we offer a hub full of resources needed for any small business owner to grow and succeed in Greater Des Moines, Iowa at dsmpartnership.com/smallbusiness. Thanks for listening.